All right, good afternoon. It is Tuesday afternoon, February 9th, 1240, and we're doing Chem 12B. Lecture this afternoon is on free radical chemistry. So we're gonna try and see if we can finish up this free radical chapter. And there's not too many reactions that are in this free radical chapter. So I think that we've got this covered. We should be able to get through what we need to get through today. We'll see. Okay, as I'm getting started, let me get a chat up so that I can see the chat stuff and questions as they come through, because you guys are really good about asking questions. And just a couple of announcements while I've got everybody here. We're still shy, a good number of people, but people will come in. So the couple of announcements that I want to hit, number one, make sure that everybody knows that I got that fourth video up online for the Grignard. So all the videos are up online for the Grignard, in case you didn't see that. Some people are letting me know that they weren't getting the emails through ochem@cabrillo.edu. And so I'm going to check that list server for a couple of people's names and make sure that everybody's included. But if you didn't get that, that video is up online and it's at chemed.study with the other videos. It was not linked in Canvas because I forgot to link it in Canvas. And so somebody reminded me today that, hey, you didn't link it in Canvas. So now it's linked in Canvas, so you can find it easier there. And I also put them all up on YouTube, and I just sent out an email giving everybody access to the YouTube thing too and where they are, so you can find them all, and everything's up online. Second thing is quizzes are graded and now are posted in Canvas. Take a look at it. I do all my comments on a separate PDF that I re-upload back into your file as a comment. So when you look at it, you won't see any comments or any writing on the file that you posted that displays automatically when you look at that page. But if you look at the comments on the right-hand side and you'll see a file attachment, click on that, that will come up with all the comments that I made. And I do a lot of comments. I do a lot of extensive communication, trying to tell you exactly what you did right or did wrong, and take a look at it, see how helpful it is, and let me know if you have any questions. You're always welcome to jump into office hours, and I make mistakes just like anybody else, and sometimes I misinterpret things. And so if you feel that I made a mistake in the grading, or you feel that I misinterpreted something that you wrote, please come let me know. I'm more than willing to discuss it, talk about it. I'm also more than willing to change the grade if I made a mistake. So that's an important thing, particularly on tests where there's a lot of small points that get added up throughout the exam, making sure that I added up everything correctly, making sure that I caught everything I was supposed to catch. I'm human just like everybody else, and sometimes I make mistakes and I like to fix them when I get them wrong. So feel free to come talk to me if that happens. Okay, I think those are my two big announcements. So let's go ahead, let's jump into this material. And we left off looking at regioselectivity. So what we did, let me head this out, free radical. And I should ask, everybody can see the screen and screen sharing properly? Okay, cool, thanks. All right, so we left off and we were looking at regioselectivity. And what we looked at was that if we did Br2 and light, that we found that the reaction was much more selective for the tertiary center than it was for either the secondary or the primary. And what I should say here is, rather than tertiary, let's hit major. And minor. And that the rates of selectivity were 1 to 85 or 82 relative rates for primary versus secondary versus tertiary was 1 to 82 to 1640. And so the way that we normally write that is we would write K relative equals the relative rates, reaction rates for those reactions. And we explain that in that this chemical reaction, when we looked at it, had an energy diagram that was an endothermic energy diagram for the, come on, snap in. Sometimes it wants to do it and sometimes it doesn't. So that when we had the proton that was here and the bromine radical, that the bromine radical pulls that proton, giving me the free radical HBr and Br2, which then grabs the bromine to complete that substitution. And that this energy here is linked to the structure of the carbon radical. And what we know is that from the carbon free radicals, that the tertiary is more stable than the secondary, and that's a lot more stable than the primary. And so we link this all through Hammond postulate. And what we had said was that the more stable a free radical is, that that lowers the activation energy for the transition state, making the reaction go faster. And so that's how we justified all of that. And this is all called regioselectivity. So here we focused on the regioselectivity. And I think of that regioselectivity as region, the region of the molecule that is reacting, where the substituent goes as it adds into it. That's what we talk about as regioselectivity, is the creation of structural isomers. Along with that, we can talk about the stereochemistry. So this was just review of where we left off, and where we launch into new is in stereochemistry. And the stereochemistry is actually a whole lot easier, because when we look at the reaction, if we take a substrate and we add Br2 with light to that substrate, what we create is something that has a stereocenter, but is entirely racemic. And the reason is that you have to look at how that reaction proceeds. That first step requires the pulling of the proton, where the bromide radical acts as a base and abstracts the proton in a free radical sense. So it's an acid-base reaction. And then when we pull that proton, what we get is a carbon that is trigonal planar. And so this is the free radical that is essentially sp2 hybridized, and it's flat and has equal access from above and below. And so it's equally likely for the molecule to react at the top as it is to react at the bottom. And so we can see from above, I would get the reaction here, which would give me the bromide attaching from the top face. That's going to push everything else down. And from the bottom face, so this would be from the top, and from the bottom, the bromide would be attached at the bottom face and push everything else up. And those two are enantiomers. And so because I get equal opportunity from both sides, what I get is something that is racemic. And so we get a 50-50 mixture. And I don't know how Zaruba dealt with stereochemistry or indicated things that were 50-50 mixtures. I typically will do a number of different things. So I just wanted, this is an opportunity for me to just talk about stereochemistry for a second. Number one, I've used a bond form here that you may not have seen before. I used what's called a wiggly bond. So we have seen before where we have used wedge bonds, where a wedge bond means that something is coming out of the plane, or a hash bond that means that something is going back in the plane. And now we've got a wiggly bond. And the wiggly bond means that it's both forwards and backwards, that you have both isomers. It is neither forwards nor backwards, it's both.
Will you scroll up a tad for just a minute more?
Yeah, sorry. Actually, what I can do is I can do it that way. And so the wiggly bond really implies both. And the things that we will use to imply racemic is we'll use the plus minus in parentheses. This means racemic. And that means that we have a 50-50 mixture of both isomers. And so any one of these three ways, or four ways, I should really say, is that we could use the plus minus, we could use the word racemic, we can use 50-50 mixture, we can use the wiggly bond. Any of those ways are ways of all indicating a mixture which is 50-50. So we have four different ways of indicating stereochemistry with that. And the important part is to realize is that when we have a free radical reaction, because the free radical is trigonal planar, it racemizes the stereocenter, meaning that it goes to a 50-50 mixture. So we could also look at a molecule that does have a stereocenter in it. And if we take this and we react it with Br2 and light, that it's going to select for the tertiary center. And as it selects for the tertiary center, the bromide radical is going to pull that proton. It's going to go through now something which is trigonal planar. And then that is going to react to grab the next bromine. And that will be racemic. So it racemizes the stereocenter. And we could do it. I needed one more there. That will help. I needed one more carbon on it.
Does the second arrow have like two heads or like one hook?
This arrow is supposed to have one.
Okay, cool.
We'll bring it in that way. We'll bring them together that way. Okay. Beyond that, once we get through stereochemistry, then the next reaction that we look at is what is called allylic halogenation. So allylic halogenation, I'm trying to move on here, and maybe it's not time. I'm looking to see if people are keeping up. Looks like you guys did pretty well. Okay, allylic halogenation is a bit different. And there's a point that I need to make about the previous stuff. I'm going to make it within the allylic halogenation in this chapter. If we look at a molecule that has a double bond, there are two allylic positions in this molecule. And we can refer to these hydrogens that are here as allylic hydrogens. The allylic hydrogens are rather acidic for these types of reactions. If we look at pulling this proton, what we generate is an allylic radical. And the other proton is still there. Maybe it's even better if I be consistent and leave that proton there and draw the radical there. This is an allylic radical. And I guess the question is, well, what's important about an allylic radical? Why did we form this as opposed to pulling one of the other protons? And the answer is resonance. That allylic radicals are resonance stabilized. And because they're resonance stabilized, that drops down the activation energy for their formation. And then from that point, we can get the bromination. And it's rather hard because I already have mechanistic detail there, so I don't want to do it there. So I'll do it over here because these are symmetrical. It won't make a difference. But where it's not symmetrical, it makes a very big difference. And this makes an allylic halogen or an allylic bromide. So one of the things that also happens, though, if we look back at this and we say, well, wait a minute, in this reaction, what we just did is we reacted it with Br2 and light. And didn't we have another reaction where we would take a double bond and react it with Br2 without light? Do you remember this reaction? And in this reaction, what happens is we first get the substitution and then we get the cyclic bromonium ion. And then the other bromide comes in and kicks out and opens it up so that what we get is we get an anti-addition of bromides. That was from the alkene chapter. Everybody recalls that? Okay, so how is that reaction different than the reaction I'm doing above? I have bromine and I have a double bond and I'm using light. Why do I only get the allylic bromide? And the answer is, I don't only get the allylic bromide. I also get some of this anti-addition of the dibromo compound. But what if I only want the allylic bromide? Is there a way that I can just get this allylic bromide? And the answer is yes. There's a way that I can suppress this other reaction. And what we do is we use a reagent that is called N-bromosuccinamide. So to avoid the electrophilic addition, we use N-bromosuccinamide. This material has a five-membered ring system where the nitrogen is attached to a halogen, to bromine. And we also have carbonyls flanking it. So this is what is known as a lactam. When we have an amide that is in a ring system, we call it a lactam. And this one is sort of a dilactam. The nitrogen being flanked on either side by carbonyls. This is called N-bromosuccinamide, and we abbreviate it NBS. N-bromosuccinamide. So that's our reagent. And when we take NBS and we treat it with light, what it does is it fragments the nitrogen bromide bond. And it does so because it creates stable free radicals. So with light, it breaks this bond homolytically. And we end up with the succinamide radical. And we end up with the bromide radical. And this guy is super stable because it has resonance to both carbonyls. So this guy is resonance stabilized. In a way that we normally wouldn't consider resonance with oxygens, but because we're not totally violating an octet rule, this actually works out in terms of the free radical nature of this reaction. The oxygen still has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 valence electrons. It doesn't have 8, but it's got the, it's close. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 that are the oxygen. So there's no formal charge on oxygen. 7 when we include the one that it's borrowing. And so it's not an octet, but it's not entirely electron deficient either. And so this type of resonance with a carbonyl is allowed for free radicals and makes this a very stable radical. And it produces, it's a source of bromine radical. So what we do then is we do this reaction with NBS rather than doing it with Br2. So what we would do is we would take that molecule that we wanted to do the allylic bromination on. We react it with N-bromosuccinamide and light, and it will generate the allylic radical.
And Jason, the reason that NBS doesn't act as a terminator when it forms it is because it forms resonance.
Its resonance makes it so stable. It's, you know, it's a lot like, is that Sterling asking?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Sterling, you know how when we use H2SO4 as an acid and we say that H2SO4 is non-nucleophilic because of all the resonance that is created with the oxygens? And it's so stable that it makes it non-nucleophilic. That's the same thing that's happening with this guy, is that it's making it non-reactive because the resonance to both of the carbonyls is decreasing the radical density essentially and making it super stable. So it is just non-reactive in that way, in the same way that acids are non-reactive that are nitrate and sulfate.
Cool, thank you.
Okay, but this we get 100%, but all is not well and good, because what happens if we take and do this? NBS and Light. How many products?
At least three.
BB, at least three. I would agree that it is at least three. It's more than three. How do we figure it out? Let's take it and let's find all of the allylic hydrogens first off. So if we just find all the allylic hydrogens, there is a hydrogen which is here, which is allylic. There is a hydrogen here, which is allylic. And there is one up on this carbon, which is allylic. So there's three allylic positions. So in that, BB is correct that there is at least three. Let's label them A, B, and C. And let's start with A, and let's pull A and see what happens. Okay, so if we pull A, then what we get is we get an allylic radical that exists in that position. And that allylic radical has resonance with the double bond. And that gives me another radical. And those two radicals, each one of those radicals gives rise to a product by grabbing a bromine. And so by grabbing the bromine, each one of these gives rise to a product. And I'm low on the page. I'm going to move this onto the next page. So there's not enough room here. Now I can do this better. I was starting to take shortcuts, and when I start to take shortcuts, it's never good. Because you all would like to see how this works. Okay, so the way it works is we grab the bromine from the NBS, generating the succinamide radical, and each one of these produces its own product. So from each proton that I pull, there are two products from each proton based on the resonance and each resonance contributor being able to be halogenated. So that means that if there's three protons that I can pull, then I end up with six products, two products from each radical. And so we could go through each one of these, but I think you can see now that I could take this and I could show the six different products. And it may be good to show, let's see if I can fit them in here. I get bromine in that position. in that position. From the terminal double bond on, or from HB, I would get that one. And that one. So these two are from HA. These two from HB. And then the last two would be that one. That one. And these two from HC. And so the question becomes, which one of these is major? And how do we know? And what do we need to look at? How do we determine what the major product is out of a chemical reaction? Anytime, out of any chemical reaction, what do we want to know? How stable it is, but is it how stable the product is or how stable what is, BB? The intermediate. Okay, so the radical, yes. Close. All of those answers are very close. It is not actually how stable the radical is, nor is it the intermediate. It's actually how high the activation is for the formation of the intermediate. It's actually the activation energy. And you can only get to it by thinking about it through Hammond postulate. So yes, we are going to look at the stability of the intermediate, but that is not what determines the actual most stable product. So we had HB, HC, and HA. And when I look at each one of these, I have a different set of free radicals. And these free radicals have resonance associated with them. So I'll look at all three just real quick. So there's one. There's two. And there is three. So we're looking at from HA, from HB, and from HC. Okay, I'll give you guys a second to catch up because I'm going too fast. So when we look at these, and we look at these radicals, what we're thinking about is the fact that I have a chemical reaction which is going from RH to R radical. And I'm interested in what this activation energy is because E sub A determines how fast my chemical reaction is. And I'm inferring stability from Hammond postulate, from Hammond postulate by understanding how stable the radical intermediate is. Does that make sense? Okay. If that makes sense, then we need to know which one of these radicals is most stable, which goes back to understanding resonance. And radical resonance is no different than regular resonance with cations and anions. It's all about stability of what you see here. And so when we look at it, what we see is we see a primary allylic radical and a secondary allylic radical. We see interestingly, I thought this was, what am I missing? Oh, I may not have constructed this exactly the way I wanted. I was thinking this was my quiz problem that I had in another sense that is a little bit different than this. This will be okay though. This is a tertiary and a secondary and a primary and a tertiary. So when I look at these and I'm thinking about them sort of which one is the most stable, when I look at primary and secondary, those are not very stable radicals. I'm more interested in the tertiary radicals. There are two that have tertiary radicals. And so these that have the tertiary radicals are more stable. And then which of these two is more stable comes down to the second pair. Notice that this is a secondary versus primary. So I go with the secondary over the primary. And that makes this guy the most stable. And so in that that is the most stable, I would expect that the two products that come out of that would be major. And one of those products is going to be more major than the other. So when I look at that one, this is sort of a bit of a memory test from last semester. I have that one product. And I have that product. What's the difference between these two products? Besides, structurally, they're very different, but what do you know about stability of double bonds? Which double bond is more stable? The second. Keegan, why the second? Four subs, good, Keegan. Okay, so the more substituted double bond is, the more stable a double bond is. So when I look at the double bond on the right-hand side, this double bond is trisubstituted. The double bond on the right is tetrasubstituted. And the more substituted a double bond is, the more stable it is. So when we look at double bonds, and we look at substitution patterns on double bonds, what we find is that they sort of rank in terms of stability. That the more substituted a double bond is, the more stable the double bond is. And where did that come into play? That came into play when we looked at chemical reactions that could go two directions. For instance, if I had a halogen here and I reacted this to do an E2 reaction, and I reacted it with a small base and I used sodium ethoxide, and I get two products that come out of this. Out of those two products, one of them we called the kinetic, and the other we called the thermodynamic. And we said that there was two different ways to promote these. We said that the kinetic was formed fast and at low temp. And the thermodynamic was slow and formed at higher temp. So in order to get the thermodynamic product, you do a long reaction at high temperature and you can push it towards the thermodynamic. To do the kinetic, you do it at a shorter reaction time and at a lower temperature. You limit the amount of energy in the system in order to be able to get to the kinetic product. These are the same. This is the thermodynamic being the more substituted double bond is thermodynamic, and the less substituted double bond is the kinetic. And they are promoted by the same types of things. Kinetic is always promoted by fast reaction times and low temp. Thermodynamic is always supported by longer reaction times and higher temperatures. And if you need a visual as to why that's the case, when we look at kinetic versus thermodynamic, we generally have a reaction that looks like this. Come on, snap in. When you want it to snap in and be all pretty, and it doesn't do it. So this is a traditional kinetic versus thermodynamic sort of picture. And what we have here are the activation energies for each. And this is thermodynamic. And this is kinetic. These reactions are reversible. So each one of these reactions can go back to starting material. And I sort of think about this almost as if this were a thing that were full of ping pong balls that are my starting materials. And the ping pong balls are being bounced around in this apparatus just by a shaker plate that's bouncing the ping pong balls. And initially what you get is you get up a buildup of ping pong balls over here really fast. And because that's the lower activation energy, so they bounce over that activation energy. But if you put more energy into the system, then they can start to bounce over and get into the thermodynamic side. And when they bounce over to that side, they have a very hard time bouncing back. So they all accumulate on the thermodynamic side. So the higher the heat is equivalent to the more bouncing. The higher the heat, the more energy there is in the system, the more accumulates in the thermodynamic side. You can also think of that in terms of a Boltzmann distribution of energies. And the kinetic energy for the thermo and the kinetic energy required for the kinetic. And so in that Boltzmann distribution, and we have molecules of all different temperatures where this is the average temp, at lower temperatures, more molecules can make it over the kinetic hurdle. And so more molecules form the kinetic product. But as you increase the temperature in the system, what winds up happening is more molecules will have the energy to get over in the thermodynamic side, but not enough energy to get back. And so at higher temperatures, you accumulate more on the thermodynamic side. So the things that favor these when looking at kinetic versus thermodynamic, I know I've got a lot of stuff in here and I want the word kinetic in here. These are favored by low temp, short reaction time. Prevents the reaction from going backwards too far if you do a short reaction time, and low temp limits the number of molecules that can make it over into the kinetic. The other one, high temp, because the molecules now accumulate in the thermodynamic sink and get stuck, or long reaction times, which every once in a while, a molecule makes it over into the thermodynamic side on the long reaction time, but isn't able to go back. And so again, they accumulate on the thermodynamic side. So there's a little sort of recap on kinetic versus thermodynamic. Okay, so let me ask you a question then. Given this starting material and NBS, and light. And let's say that this is, these are usually done in carbon tetrachloride. Carbon tetrachloride has a fairly low boiling point. I think it is around 60 degrees. So let's go ahead and do this 60 degrees, which is at the boiling point, which means that this is hot. And we'll do it for 10 hours, which is sort of an extended amount of time. So this is both hot and long reaction time. What are the two products that are formed, and what is my major product? In other words, what we're saying is that this is under thermodynamic control or thermodynamic conditions. So what are my two products, and which one is major? Take a second, think about it. The substrate was chosen so that there's only two possible products. Pull the proton that's allylic, do the resonance. Each resonance contributor leads to one product. Look at the structures, assess the stability of the double bond. So the steps are pull allylic proton, resonance, substitute, draw products, assess double bond. Determine major. For given conditions. Okay, BB's got an idea here. So I'm going to take and draw the radical, the resonance. My arrows are getting sloppy. I'll slow down. So those are my two resonance contributors. Those are going to lead to two products. Bromide in that position, and bromide in that position. This guy is monosubstituted. This one is tetrasubstituted. The tetrasubstituted should be the more stable of the double bonds, the thermodynamic product. This is kinetic. And this one is major. Yeah, you can name molecules too. That works too.
Did I get the name right, or is that wrong?
Let's see, how would we name it? We would name it with the double bond having to have the lowest possible number. So it'd be a 1, 2, 3, 4 for nomenclature. And it would be a 4-bromo, 1-methyl, 2-butene. Or but-2-ene would be the other way. As an end name for that. So you can do it both ways. So I think it's your 3-methyl that's off. It would be a 2-methyl. Yeah, good. Always nice to check nomenclature real quick too. Good to catch everything here. All right, so there's a
question really quick, sorry.
Please, go Kendra.
So does the kinetic product also form in those conditions, even though
there- It does. It does. Okay. There's no way to completely eliminate it. There's no way to push it 100% towards a thermodynamic, just like there is no way to push it 100% towards kinetic. You're always going to get a product split. It just depends on which one is going to be major. And the amount of energy difference between the two in terms of the stability determines what the split is. So there's no real good way to tell you what the split is on this. I would expect a split that is somewhere maybe in the 60-40 or 70-30, somewhere in that range towards the major. What I will say is that it is easier to limit the amount of energy, and it is easier to get higher product ratios of the kinetic. It is harder to get good, higher yields of the thermodynamic always. It's just a harder thing to do. And so if we chill this thing down and we give it just enough energy to get over this hump, we can really limit how much gets to the thermodynamic. But when you have enough...
Because like if you turn the temperature up super high, it'll just boil off, or?
No, it's because if I turn the temperature up super high, what happens is if there's enough energy to get over this one, there's always enough energy to get over this one. And statistically, you're always going to have some amount that are going to get stuck in here. So it's about the Boltzmann distribution and how much energy. When you turn the temperature up super high, there are still some molecules that are just moving really slow. It's just always about a probability distribution of the energies associated with all those molecules. And they're not all moving at the same speed all the time. And we oftentimes forget that. We think a temperature means absolute something. They're all moving the same, and they're not. So that's a good questions. Thank you for that.
I have another question.
Please.
So if we were to have a problem like this on the quiz, do you want us to write kinetic and thermo, or like how many substitutes it has to show which one's major?
What I generally do is I am usually pretty clear. I'll either tell you it's under thermodynamic conditions or kinetic conditions. So I don't have you just look at this and guess. So you don't have to figure out what is a high temp and what is a low temp, or what is a long time or a short time. I typically will tell you, you're running this under thermodynamic conditions. What is my major product? In that case, just letting me know tetrasubstituted, monosubstituted, thermodynamic product, major. That's enough. You do not have to draw all the energy diagrams and everything. Okay.
So Jason, if we...
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, go for it, Keegan. I'll ask after.
I was just wondering to jump on that. If you increase the time from 10 hours to like 20 or 30, would that add a little more to the thermo product?
Generally,
like slightly more?
Generally, not a whole lot, because once you reach equilibrium and you reach equilibrium for the reaction. So remember that reactions also have a, dynamic equilibrium. What am I trying to say? It's the reaction quotient, which turns into the reaction, K value, and the K value for the reaction tells you where the reaction stops when it reaches dynamic equilibrium. And turning the temperature, letting it run longer does not change the K value. Once it reaches equilibrium, then it's stuck at equilibrium, and it doesn't matter how much longer you react it, you can't get it out of equilibrium. What you could do is you could change the temperature, and that will change the K value, and that will change the equilibrium values, but longer reaction time after it reaches equilibrium will not change anything.
Okay, so if we change the solvent to something that boiled at a higher temp, then you could...
Then you could access higher temperatures and you could change things that way, yes. Good point. Drew, you're up.
All right, Jason, so if we ran this under kinetic conditions, would the kinetic product be the only product we get? So that would be the major, because the thermodynamic...
It wouldn't be the only, it would be the major product, but you would still get something like an 80-20 split. You're still going to get some of that thermodynamic product creeping in there.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a quick question as well.
JC, go.
I don't mean to like be redundant, but
So I'm having trouble wrapping my mind around why kinetic favors a less stable double bond arrangement.
Usually in the kinetic, we have this type of energy diagram. So this energy diagram, let me change this and see if I can make this diagram a little bit better. Let me style it red and say that this has higher activation energy. But more stable product. And let's change the other picture and style it blue. And this has a lower activation energy. But less stable product. When you have this type of situation, we get into what is called kinetic versus thermodynamic. This is the definition of kinetic versus thermodynamic. And so it allows this product to act as a thermodynamic sink. Now there's another situation that can occur that we're not looking at. Let me take this diagram. Let me copy this diagram. And let me show you another diagram that things could be different. So we'll keep this diagram right here. I'll shrink it down a bit so I can put another diagram next to it. The other diagram that I want to show is one where I have a product that may be here and another product that may be here. And this type is not kinetic versus thermodynamic. This product has one product that is always major, because it is both lower activation energy and more stable. And this product up here is always minor. The situation on the left is kinetic versus thermodynamic. And is specific to certain types of reactions. The other one is more common. And when we look at products that are like carbocation formations, where we can get different types of carbocation formations, and one product is always minor because you're looking at the more stable carbocation and there's no selectivity beyond that. And all the other products are always minor because they have higher activation energies, and the lowest activation energy is the lowest product and the most stable product. That's more common for most chemical reactions, and why we usually get a single product, which is major. Kinetic versus thermodynamic is really unique in that one has a short activation temperature, but not very stable, high activation energy, and yet very stable. And so that sets up a condition where temperatures can promote which reaction is favored or which product is favored. Does that, JC, was your question, right? Does that help a little bit?
Yeah, I was thinking like, oh yeah, if it's a more stable thing, then obviously, you know, that would be like, why would you not just go for that? But it's an investment game.
And yes. Think,
yeah.
Nice way to put it. Yes. I like that. So not a redundant question at all. And thank you for that. That's a great question. What else do I need to tell you in here? There are a lot of things in this chapter that are sort of informational, but not super critical for what we need to do. We already covered some of the polymer stuff. And I think that that really the major things in this chapter are the ones of synthetic utility. So just some more interesting things here that sometimes in hydrocarbon reforming or hydrocarbon processing from crude oil, that one of the things that they do is cracking, where they take long chain hydrocarbons and they heat them up. And in heating them up, they split the molecules in a free radical reaction that can break them apart. They can do hydrocracking. Which is where they take these long chain hydrocarbons and they treat them with hydrogen gas and heat. And they do hydrogenations at the same time, so they're not ending up with double bonds. Or they can do reforming. All of these, again, are just sort of for interest, just to understand that these are all free radical processes. And in the reforming, they're creating branched molecules. And they can create a lot of different isomers in that. And all of these are all free radical thermal processes. They're basically just heating the crap out of them until they break the molecules apart. But what's really useful for us, beyond all of those things, synthetically useful out of this chapter, the two big things that I want to get, are these. It's the ability to take a molecule and to treat it with a halogen and light and be able to halogenate it and introduce functionality. I think of this as a handle that I can do other things with. You're putting a handle onto the molecule that you can then turn into a Grignard, do an elimination, make an alkene. You can then do electrophilic addition. You can do SN2 reactions. You've added new functionality to the molecule that allows you to do other things with it. So that is the big reaction. The other one is being able to take things that have double bonds on them and be able to introduce functionality in that way as well, and kinetic versus thermodynamic. And having some control over which one of these products we actually make. Those are the two big reactions that are coming out of this chapter that are new things that we can do. And in regards to this first one, we said that, you know, tertiary is more reactive than secondary, which is more reactive than primary for bromination, which is really important. for adding a bromine. But there is a huge, huge but. That's for induction. And that there are other things that are more stabilizing than induction. What's more stabilizing than induction?
Resonance.
I see a bunch of people queued up there. That was perfect. That's exactly right. Resonance is more important than induction. And so I could give you a problem. I can envision one right now where I could take something that, that I could do Br2 and light and ask you for what the major product is for this reaction. And I can envision drawing a product where I get the bromide in that position, but also in that position. Which one of those two is major?
Bromine closer to the oxygen because of resonance stabilization.
Exactly, Drew. The second one. And it has to do with the free radicals. So if we look at the free radicals, we're looking at the tertiary free radical versus the free radical, which is alpha to the oxygen. And the oxygen has resonance, not in the way that we would think. The resonance is a little bit different with this oxygen. So when you do radical resonance in this way, we're gonna, I'm trying to do a nice arrow that is just one arrow movement. This is the radical resonance with the oxygen. And that makes this lower energy. And that makes this a faster reaction. And this guy over here, no resonance. Okay, so this has two implications. There's two important parts here in my 10 minutes that I get left in this class. And that is that free radical reactions are very sensitive to the stability of the free radical, and that resonance can also play a really big role. So don't get locked into tertiary, and always going tertiary. Open your mind to other possibilities that resonance can play a big role in this, and think about resonance as well. And one of the things that's really important in this is that this is a solvent called THF, tetrahydrofuran. In oxygen, tetrahydrofuran has a problem in with a little bit of moisture in that it forms this guy. This is an organic peroxide. And the reason that it forms is because oxygen is a diradical. And in being a diradical, it abstracts the proton alpha to the hydrogen because it creates a resonance stabilized free radical. And that resonance stabilized free radical can then react with another oxygen. And then this guy will pick up a proton eventually from water, from moisture. And become the organic peroxide. This happens relatively quickly. THF is a very common solvent to use. THF, if not protected from air, forms organic peroxides, which are solids, which are contact explosives. And when you go to open the bottle, the entire bottle detonates. It can be deadly. So anytime you see solvents that are ether solvents that have any crystals anywhere in them or around the neck or around the neck of the flask, you never open them. You never touch them. You call the bomb squad and you let the bomb squad detonate it and deal with it, because there's a high likelihood that these things in just exposure to oxygen form these organic peroxides, which are solids and are contact explosives. And when they go, they take the entire bottle and all of the THF with it. So the whole thing just becomes one big sort of fireball.
How are they able to store that?
What we do, that's a great question, is we oftentimes store it in a apparatus to distill it. And we store it with a metal, sodium metal, which makes a free radical and locks it up as a free radical. And then we distill it out. But when we store it in what's called an ampule. The ampule is a bottle that has a ground glass joint in it. And a stopcock. And what we do is we put two rubber septa over the tops of these caps. And your liquid is in here. And when we want to use it and we want to access it, this is stored entirely with nitrogen gas above the THF so that no air can get in here. And when we want to get the THF out, we take a needle that comes from a gas tank and we push N2 in. And then we take a long needle that is hooked to a syringe and we go all the way through the stopcock and we pull out the amount that we need, replacing what we're pulling out with nitrogen gas. And then no air ever gets into that bottle. And we close that stopcock as soon as we pull the needle out. And so we never let air into the bottle, and that can protect it for years and years and years. So I have some at Cabrillo that I have stored in an ampule like this that they keep wanting me to throw away. And I'm like, don't touch it. Don't throw it away. It's like 5 years old. It's still good because it's never had anything but nitrogen gas in there. It's never had any air or water in it. And I'm super careful with it. So one more thing I want to show you, and that is that normally when we think about resonance, when we think about resonance and we look at this type of resonance with a free radical, we understand this resonance to be a stabilizing resonance. When we, so how do I frame this? I'm going to back up. I'll bring this back in a second. Let's do this.
Are you still doing an example to describe synthetic utility?
I'm sorry, can you ask one more time?
Are you still doing an example to describe synthetic utility?
I am doing an example. No, I'm moving on from the synthetic utility to describe. I'm moving into a sort of a resonance thing where I want to look at the stability and some issues with resonance.
Is there like a name for the reaction or like a label we could do?
I'm just going to talk about resonance stabilizing groups.
Thank you.
Okay, Sterling and Drew are out on this discussion for a second. One of these is okay and good, and one of these is bad. One of these is allowable in terms of resonance, and one is not. which one is okay and which one is not. Sterling and Drew just dying right now.
Is it the first one, since it's oxygen still has 8 electrons?
It is, Keegan, that's good. Yeah, this one is good. And the reason is oxygen has its octet. And this one is bad because we've done an octet violation. And oxygen is too electronegative to undergo the octet. Zaruba said that, don't take bananas from angry monkeys. I gave Zaruba that. I've been doing monkeys and bananas forever. The electrons, that's funny. The electrons are like monkey, are like bananas, and the oxygen is an 800 pound gorilla. So I don't use angry monkey, I use 800 pound gorilla. And the oxygen being the behemoth that it is in terms of electron withdrawing capability and electronegativity is like the 800 pound gorilla of elements. And if you take the gorilla's banana, the gorilla gets angry. Things, bad things happen. So you don't take the electrons away from the gorilla, and you don't do the octet violation. Free radicals are different. Free radicals, really cool, do both types of resonances, and they can resonate with traditional groups that carbocations cannot. This is okay. This is actually, interestingly enough, okay. And the last one is
on the last one you drew, I think you left that a lone pair on the right hand side of the arrow. On the opposite.
What I left off was that, I believe.
Yeah, of that arrow.
Oh, I see what I'm saying. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
that's it. And then the last one. Is this one, and this is okay. And so what we see is that free radicals are stabilized by electron withdrawing groups and by electron donating groups, which is super cool. And that what happens is that we can actually combine electron donating groups and electron withdrawing groups to make super stable free radicals. All you need to do is take and combine both types, what's called a pi donor and a pi acceptor, and you get what's called a captodative system. If we take and we look at an element that has lone pairs like an oxygen and another one that has lone pairs here. This system is what is called a captodative system. And it's super stable because it has what is an electron withdrawing group and an electron donating group, and we get the resonance from both. And so what happens is the resonance looks like this. And all octets are satisfied, and we end up with something that is a Zwitter ion with both a positive and negative charge, and it makes the thing super stable. And so there's examples of this where free radicals are super stable for days. So for instance, you can have a free radical in a six-membered ring system with an aromatic ring system here that has all of these types of resonances, both electron withdrawing and electron donating. And this free radical is stable for days. And it's due to the electron withdrawing group and the electron donating group that are flanking that free radical. And so it's stabilized by both. And that is just super cool. And in particular, it's really this one that we just don't expect, where traditional electron withdrawing groups can act to stabilize free radicals that we just wouldn't normally expect. And so that's the last part that really comes out of this, is just to watch your resonance, and that some traditional groups that don't do resonance, like carbonyls, can stabilize free radicals alpha to the carbonyl. And it's a little bit different than we expect. And so that's kind of why I wanted to highlight that. But mainly, my main thing that I want to get out of this are these two. And being able to do these two are super important. And that's what we'll utilize a lot going forward as we go into the synthesis chapter, into the next chapter. Okay. So I'm going to get a free radical quiz up online. I'll get some problems up online too. And that free radical quiz will leave open through the weekend and give you some time to work in this chapter and work on the problems before you need to tackle it. But that's where we're going.
Could you scroll back down to that last, I guess, drawing?
Here?
Yeah, thanks.
You're welcome. All right, so I think that's everything for today. I'm going to go ahead and stop the recording. And anybody who wants to stay on the line is welcome to, and I'll answer questions. And other than that, I'll see the afternoon lab at 3 o'clock. And we'll pick it up from there.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.